by prosecuting the criminals, especially the notorious Jarrell Jackson. For him, it was a dream come true. He was finally getting what he wanted, publicity. It was time to think about running for mayor. The courtroom was packed, the majority of the people black. They had come to sit this one in. A lot of families that had lost a life to the hands of the junior mafia were there watching, hoping, and praying for justice. Justice that hadn't been served. The prosecutor was their god. Only he could give them what they wanted. Only he could bring justice for this cruel and wanton behavior that had swept through the streets like Satan himself. Paul Perschetti came through the double courtroom doors, his trench coat swinging as he made his entrance. He was on an all-time high. Things were looking good. He felt the power of City Hall calling him.
"All rise," said the bailiff, as the Honorable Eugene Pearlstein entered the courtroom.
"You may be seated," he said stiffly after sitting down. Voir dire had taken 3 weeks. Perschetti had used his peremptory challenges early on, giving Jarrell's attorney, Billy DeStefano, a slight edge in the jury selection. As far as DeStefano was concerned, he wanted his client to beat the case. Hell, he knew he was defending the so-called leader of the junior mafia, but he didn't care. The bottom line was that the niggas and their bullshit had made him a millionaire at the age of 36. Why stop now? He could not stand nor afford for Jarrell to be sentenced. There was no way he was going to let his client receive capital punishment, which was exactly what the state was going for. Voir dire, one of the biggest problems with the justice system, is the method of jury selection in American jurisprudence. It was totally unfair, but DeStefano felt good about the 12 jurors who were selected. The judge explained to the jurors exactly what their job was, which was to find guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Court was adjourned until the following morning. DeStefano went back to his office. He rehearsed his opening statement over and over again, preparing himself for the jurors, ready to look them dead in their eyes and tell them why they wouldn't be finding his client guilty. When he was finished, not only would the jury be dazzled, but also the verdict would be not guilty. He had $175,000 so far, and had another $50,000 due him for the professional services he rendered. The world had gone mad, and he was making money. His dead president's fantasy was interrupted by his secretary.
"Billy, your wife is on line 3, she said over the intercom.
"Thank you," he said, picking up the line. Finishing with his wife on the phone faster than his record-breaking connubial speed, he hung up and told his secretary to hold all his calls so he can go over his opening statement one last time. It was short, simple, and to the point. It stated as succinctly as possible, just to whet the jurors' appetites, anticipating what was to come. He had a promising future right there in the palm of his hands. The publicity alone was phenomenal, not to mention all the incoming calls for potential clients he had not yet had a chance to review. Thanks to the junior mafia, he was famous, and he would get Jarrell Jackson off. He had no doubts about it.
"All rise."
Judge Pearlstein seemed to take his sweet time sitting his fat ass in his chair. Jarrell couldn't figure him out. Perschetti made his opening statement. Then DeStefano gave his opening performance. After opening statements were concluded, the prosecutor presented his evidence, then called his first witness, a hotel clerk, who claimed he remembered two guys coming into the hotel and walking past him. When asked if either were sitting in the courtroom, he pointed at Jarrell.
"Ain't that some shit? Ran and Sam went up in the hotel," he whispered to Billy.
"At least he's honest," thought Billy, as he glanced over and looked at his client.
The prosecutor seemed to introduce something into evidence about every 10 minutes. From pictures to diagrams, he introduced it all, except a weapon. DeStefano objected to everything, and Pearlstein was getting tired of telling his ass overruled. A great deal of investigation and preparation had been done by the DA, and it was a shame that all the work he had done was a waste of time, because DeStefano was going to get his client off. For $225,000, he knew he had better. DeStefano did a good job on cross-examination.
"Well, at the time of night, it's possible you were tired, and you didn't know who you saw walk into the lobby of the hotel. From 50 yards away, how could anyone know if it was my client walking into that hotel room?" He asked each question with sincerity, constantly watching the jurors.
"Objection!" said the prosecutor, really wanting to say, "Fuck you," as did DeStefano, but the judge overruled him anyway.
"Ha!"
DeStefano wanted to say, thinking about the $500 he spent feeding Judge Pearlstein dinner last night. "Ha ha" was more like it. DeStefano just took over the courtroom, making liars out of all of Proschetti's witnesses, until Proschetti called his last witness. "Prosecution calls Christopher Cole." Christopher Cole, a paraplegic. Christopher Cole, a.k.a. 40. By the time 40 got off the stand, the jurors were in tears. A mean stare was what they gave DeStefano and his client. Jarrell just wanted someone to shoot 40's ass.
"Can't you do nothing to shut him up?" Jarrell asked.
"What do you want me to do?" Billy answered.
"I don't know, object to something," said Jarrell. "For a $250,000, do something, damn!"
Jarrell was really getting nervous. 40 spoke directly to the jurors, telling them everything, from the girl, to the kidnapping, to the basement where he was kept, until they received the $1 million. He told them how he pulled off Sam's mask, and how Randolph and Jarrell Jackson took off their masks willingly. He told them that Jarrell Jackson was the one who pulled the trigger on him, first in his legs and then in his chest. He told them that he put the gun to his head and shot him. DeStefano cross-examined him, not able to break his story or intimidate him into giving the wrong answer, no matter how many ways he asked his questions. That had always been DeStefano's forte, causing people to twist themselves up and make themselves sound like they weren't sure of what they were saying. But it didn't work. 40 knew what he was doing, and he knew why he was there. He wanted justice. He deserved justice. And justice would be his. In Gina's world, the months passed quickly, and with them, so did her savings. It had been 6 months since Kadir died, and Gina didn't know if she was coming or going. Her brooding was in direct proportion to her financial situation. The beauty and change that comes with spring didn't come for Gina. Instead, she talked to herself and stayed in her room, which she shared with Kalir. Gwendolyn's other baby, Brandy, stayed in Gaget's room. Gwendolyn was still in jail because Gaget wouldn't let Gina put up the bail money.
"No need in wasting. God says it's a sin to waste, and Gwendolyn ain't right. So you just hold on to your money in case you need it."
Gina had nothing going on for herself. There were no adventures, no nights out on the town, no dinners in AC, gambling and spending frivolously, and no romance. She missed the romance of Kadir, the way he would grab her and hold on to her in a rough passion, tasting her, serving her his penis, which was one of a god, thick and fat with the perfect length. Just the thought of him sent chills down her spine. Only Qua could take Gina far beyond any fantasy ever could. Kadir. She felt him all the time. She talked to him every night. She cried for him in her sleep, twisting and turning, talking in the bunk bed above Kalir. Sometimes Kalir would sleep in the bedroom with Gaget and his baby sister. There wasn't good sleep for Kalir with the new baby either. Normally, Kalir would be found sleeping on the kitchen floor and the closets in the bathtub. Gaget couldn't figure it. Finally, one night, she caught him sleepwalking and called 911. Gina couldn't believe it. Not the fact that 911 woke the neighborhood at 4 in the morning, but the fact that Gaget blamed Kalir's sleepwalking on her because she was always talking to a dead man.
You talked the boy right out of the room, Gina,
Gogget had said.
Things just seemed to be going downhill. Even Gucci, the precious Persian kitty, had his share of life in the hood. One day, while Gina was out, Gary and his friends were in the house rolling poor Gucci up against the wall like dice. Gina was so upset when she came in the house to see Gucci being tossed like a football, she didn't speak to Gary for 2 weeks. The poor cat was never the same. He had started climbing up the walls and jumping on people as they walked by. Usually, he would climb on top of the refrigerator and wait for someone to walk in the kitchen, then jump on their heads. They had worked on Gucci every time Gina left the house. He had become a mean cat, and now he was evil. Gina couldn't stand him. He had changed so much. He wasn't cute and cuddly anymore. Now Gucci was a mean old tomcat with long, straggly hair. Gucci blamed Gina for the bad meals and torture he was put through and usually would attack her on sight. Gogget just wanted the cat out of her house. Then there were the twins. Bria and Brianna weren't living in the same world with the rest of the people on the planet. They had boyfriends now. Life was Kevy Kev, and don't tell Bria it wasn't, 'cause it would be something if you did. Brianna was blinded by the gold teeth, obviously, of some kid named Dalvin.
He's all that. He's all that. We use condoms. It's my life.
Yes, they were into sex. Heavily into sex, and definitely down for experimentation. What was Gina going to tell them? It's 1990. You can catch AIDS. Like that would lead them in the right direction.
They don't believe. They just don't believe,
Gina thought. So she kept her mouth shut and always said,
did the condom break? Because if it did, you got 6 months to see if you'll die.
No, Gina, it's not like that. Brianna just stared at her as if Gina was retarded. Dalvin was a virgin until he met me.
He told you that?
Gina shook her head in disbelief, knowing game when she heard it. Of course he was a virgin. Are you crazy? Brianna asked. This girl was out there. Gina's mental level could not deal with the minds of just-turned 17-year-olds. They just knew they were grown. There was no reasoning with them and what they wanted to do. They did. Gogget kept fussing, and Gina would get real tired of the whole routine inside the house. But outside, it was worse. The brothers seemed so angry. People were frighteningly frustrated. The inner city streets were hard and represented hard times. Gina hated it, the way it looked, all scribbled on and wasted. Gina had become a hermit, like Gogget. She hated going outside at night. It was always something. The brothers wasn't taking no shorts in the streets either. They would rob you in a minute and victimize you for the smallest amounts of materials or cash you may have. It was chaos and mass confusion. She missed Kadir so much. It had been 6 months, going on 7 since his murder, and nothing had changed. She still loved him, and she still wanted him. She couldn't forget him. She talked to him every day and night. Nightmares of Kwa's death took the place of the happily ever after dreams, and Gina often woke in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, filled with a fear whose name she knew but wouldn't say. Despair. When she lost Kadir, she lost it all, including her spirit. The summer months were getting hotter, and it only added to her ennui.
Maybe an air conditioner will help,
she thought. She called Rick. It wasn't a problem.
Two air conditioners?
Gina, that's not a problem.
And $5,000?
That's not a problem either, G.
No problem,
Gina thought.
Now that's what friends are for. Thank you, Rick. I'm on my way,
she said, hanging up the phone. She ran into Gogget's room.
You got some money?
No, baby, not yet. I will when the mailman gets here, though. Today's the 1st of July, said Gogget, playing with her false teeth. Gina wasn't trying to hear it. She went outside and walked to the corner store. If she was lucky, she'd see someone who would loan her the money. She hated having to ask, but $5 shouldn't be a problem since they were out there selling caps on the very corner of her block.
She was wearing a pair of jean shorts with a Chanel t-shirt tucked inside, and a fresh pair of Reeboks. As she walked on the sidewalk, the kids were playing in the street. People were sitting outside anywhere they could find shade and a cool breeze. The summer heat was unbearable. Gina's Mercedes-Benz sat in the sun, sparkling as if it were on a showroom floor. Gina crossed the street and walked up to the store like she was going in.
"How y'all doing?"
she asked. "Yo, Gina, what's going on, baby?" asked Rob.
"Nothing, just chilling,"
she said. "Yo, Gina, think you could drop me off at my mom's on 29th and Lee?" he asked.
"Yeah, I can do that. But you're gonna have to give me some gas,"
she said. "That's no problem. When you gonna take me?" he said.
"I'll take you now."
"Bet. Come on, let's go."
"No, Rob, you gotta go get the gas and bring it back here before we can go."
"Girl, is you crazy? The nearest gas station is on Broad Street," said Rob, looking at his boy, Shambi.
"I'll go get the gas,"
she said. "Yeah, you're gonna have to go, 'cause it's hotter than a motherfucker out here. Shit, I might fall out of something," he said. "How you rolling a Mercedes-Benz with no gas, Gina?" Shambi asked.
"Look, times are hard, okay?"
"Here, Gina," Rob said, as he handed her a $5 bill.
"I'll be right back."
"Mm-hmm," he said, nodding as she walked off, pocketing his $5. "Shit, times must be hard. It wouldn't be no way. She walking to the gas station," he said, shaking his head, unable to believe it. Gina walked 6 blocks to the nearest gas station and got a gallon of gas, which she carried in a milk container. She was tired from the walk. The hot sun blazed as she walked down the city street. She turned the corner as a black Mercedes-Benz turned the corner and pulled up alongside her. It slowed, and Gina knew it was about to stop for her. "Yo, Gina, you okay? You need a ride or anything?" asked the guy behind the wheel. With the sun blaring in her eyes, she didn't know who it was until she bent down and saw Jamal smiling at her.
"Hi, Jamal,"
she said, with a smile back at him. It was good seeing him, especially since she was in true blue need of a ride. It had been a long time. So much had happened. She had changed, and one would hope that he had too. Of course, he questioned the gasoline in the milk container before dropping her off in the front of her car. "I'll see you around," he said.
"Thanks, Jamal. I appreciate it."
She situated the gas problem, dropped Rob off, and went straight to Rick's house. He had just moved into a nice house off the main line. Rick was all that. He was still hustling, of course. But he was so kind to Gina, and she was truly grateful. "Where's my kiss?" he said to her as she walked through the door. Gina and Rick sat for a while talking about how time had changed things for both of them. Gina, not really wanting to let him know how right he was about moving back home, sort of came out of nowhere and told him she was ready to move. Rick just looked at her. He didn't want to say, "I told you so." So he didn't question her at all. Just said they could contact a few realtors and start looking around for her a new place tomorrow. Gina was excited and content with hearing that. For the first time in a long time, she thought of all her furnishings and storage.
"Can I come up here with you, Rick?"
she asked, knowing his house had to be a couple hundred thousand at least. "Yeah, there's some houses around here for sale," he said, thinking of the advantages of having Gina close by. After she left Rick, she went to an appliance shop and bought 2 air conditioners, a big one for downstairs and a small one for her bedroom. Gina felt good. Rick gave up loot, like Kadir always did. There was something about walking around with a couple thousand in your pocket. Gina had forgot the feeling. She dropped the air conditioners off at Gaget's and went to Le Chevaux. Everyone was real happy to see her. Bev wasn't there. She and Charlie had just had a baby. So some girl named Lisa did her hair. When she was through, she stopped by her post office box to check for mail, something she rarely did. She had gotten a post office box when Kadir's mother, Viola, put her out. With her,
Mine, mine, it's all mine, routine.
Gina hadn't checked on the box much. There was never any mail to her, just a lot of junk mail and mail for Kadir. Unlocking the box, she found 13 envelopes. Getting back into the safety of the Mercedes-Benz, she opened up each letter and scanned over the mail. There were 3 letters from a realtor and a notice to vacate addressed to Kadir Richards, 234 Green Street.
Damn, what's this?
Gina whispered to herself. She started the car and went back to the house. She called the number on the notice, but got an answering machine. It was a real estate office, but the office was closed. Gina hung up the phone. She sat on the edge of her bed and read the notice over and over to herself. 234 Green Street. She wasn't even sure what part of the city that was. Gogget had the air conditioners pumping cool air into the hot and stuffy housing project unit.
Keep that door closed,
she hollered to Kalir, who liked running in and out.
Child, here, drink some water, she said to him. You gonna fall out. It's too hot out there. Sit your ass down and rest yourself, son. I'm okay, Gogget,
he said, walking toward the door.
Boy, sit your ass down and rest a minute, she said, rocking Brandy.
Gina came running down the stairs.
Gogget, I'll be back,
she said as she flew out the door with Kadir's diamond key chain in her hand. Gina got in the car again and dashed through the projects, not stopping at any stop signs and turning corners like the police were chasing after her. People outside just watched as her car drove by them. Gina drove straight to Green Street and followed it down to Second. Nothing looked familiar. Gina grabbed the notice in her jean shorts and looked at it. 234 Green Street was an apartment building. Now she remembered. She remembered all too well. One night, Kadir went into the same building and left her outside. She looked at Kwa's Diamond Q keychain. Parking the car, she went to the front door. After several tries, she finally found the key that fit and unlocked the front door. Gina took the elevator up to the 3rd floor. Apartment 307 was down the hall. She stood there, not knowing what to do.
Should I knock? What if it's some bitch and she can't pay the rent because Quadir's gone?
The thoughts went through her as she desperately fumbled with the keychain. She found the key. She turned it to the left and then to the right. The lock snapped and the door opened. The apartment was too fly. It was living the way living used to be. Leather furniture, a pool table, and a bar in the dining room. Vertical blinds at all the windows. And track lights throughout. An 80-inch screen in the living room and a 60-inch in the bedroom. On the table sat a picture of Kwanda and Kadir when she was first born. She'd never seen that picture before. Looking around the living room, she noticed the fine layer of dust covering everything. She could tell the place hadn't been occupied. The garbage in the kitchen had an unbearable odor that filled the air. She opened some windows, letting in fresh air. The bathroom light wouldn't go on, since there was no Kadir to pay the electric bill. The bedroom walls and ceiling were covered with mirrors. Gina noticed a picture of Sherelle with Kwanda sitting on his bureau, causing her heart to sink. There was another picture of Kadir on the dresser with some other girl Gina had never seen before. She found a photo album on a shelf. More girls. Pictures from Jones Beach in New York with every rapper and groupie on the East Coast. And the Greek in Fairmont Park. The Greek in Virginia Beach. Pictures at the Rutgers basketball games with the rappers and the ballers from Kumo D to Alpo. There were pictures out in Vegas and Atlantic City and the Mike Tyson fights. Kadir was even on the West Coast in Cali with everyone you could think of. From Ice-T to Ice Cube on down the line. The nigga was everywhere with everybody and had pictures to prove it. She kept flipping the pages, scanning every pretty face and slim but voluptuous figure her man was leaning up against. She had put down the photo album and began opening up the dressers. All the drawers were filled and neatly arranged. The walk-in closet was lined in Dapper Dan leathers and a few fur coats. On the other wall were his tailor-made clothing at one end, and down at the bottom were about 50 boxes of shoes he had never bothered to place on his shoe rack. Kwai had as many clothes here as he had at the house. The different outfits, the different clothing. The constant switch, never in the same car twice. All the things she saw once, but never saw again, popped in and out of her mind. She went around the rest of the apartment, looking in the closets, taking her time, remembering the clothes she had seen him wear. They were staring at her. She felt good. She felt bad. She felt miserable. She went back over to the closet and fumbled through his clothes, taking items and holding them up to her as if he were in them. Kadir's scent again. How wonderful life was to just have the scent of him again. The apartment was filled with a mysterious aura. It was as if Kwa was there, as if someone was watching everything she did. Gina thought she heard something. Her poor heart started pounding. She went out into the living room, but no one was there. She looked in the kitchen, and then secured the chain on the door. Gina walked past another closet door. It wouldn't open. She tried every key until she found the key that fit the lock. Suddenly, she felt a hand grasp her shoulder and let her free. Her heart pounded. Startled, she dropped the keys. She turned around as a cold chill went through her body. She looked behind her to see the apartment, as it was when she had first entered. She reached down and grabbed the Diamond Q keychain. Finding the key, she opened the door, and staring in her face was a gray safe. A safe that sat on the floor and stood above her. It looked like something from out of a bank. Gina couldn't believe it. She could not believe what she had found. The safe. Kwa's safe. Kadir's money. She dropped to the floor in disbelief. DeStefano put forth all his evidence. There were cross-examinations, redirect examinations, over and over again. Finally, DeStefano called Charisse Harding to the stand. The prosecutor jumped up.
I object. That name is not on the list.
Counsel approached the bench. DeStefano explained the relevance of the witness's testimony and that suppressing her testimony would not be fair just because there were no prior statements made by her concerning the criminal matter. She had recently come forth with crucial information concerning the case. Finally, it was settled. Ms. Harding would be allowed to testify. Court would be adjourned for a brief recess. Gina paced and continued pacing, searching the apartment for anything and everything she could find. Startled by the knocking at the door, she looked out the peephole at a short, light brown-skinned man, wearing a pair of glasses that seemed to enlarge themselves through the tiny glass peephole in the door.
Who is it?
Locksmith, you called?
Well, it's about time,
Gina thought to the door.
You called about a safe?
Yeah, hi, thanks for coming.
No problem.
Gina led him into the apartment.
Is this your apartment?
Yes, it is. Why?
She asked, leading him to the locked closet door where the safe was.
I was just wondering. It's very nice,
he said, noticing that it didn't look lived in.
You sure you can open my safe?
She asked.
I need to see the safe.
Oh, great,
Gina thought. Just what I need. What do you mean you got to see it? She asked, unlocking the door.
Damn, that's a big one. That cost a lot of money right there.
What cost a lot of money that wasn't worth having?
Gina thought.
You can get it open, right?
She said.
Yeah, I can get it open.
How?
Well, there's several ways to get into a safe. You can blow it open, or you can use a torch, he said.
Oh, is that what you're gonna do?
I can. It's a lot quicker. The only thing is, when you use those methods, you risk damage to what's inside. You know, you can set what's inside on fire.
Oh, no, we won't be going that route. That's not the way.
Gina could see herself now, trying to salvage burning money.
How are you going to get it open?
The courtroom was packed, as people swarmed among themselves, finally taking their seats. All were present, waiting on Judge Pearlstein. Finally, everyone rose. Then, after Pearlstein's journey to his bench, they sat. Counsel for the defendant called his witness. Charisse Wilson Harding made an appearance of a lifetime. The bitch wasn't bullshitting. She strutted down the aisle in a pale blue linen suit, clutching a pale blue Chanel bag by her side. Her hair was done, and her makeup looked like something from a beauty counter. "Miss Harding, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?" With her hand on the Bible, she answered, "I do." "You may be seated." And so the drama began, from "State your full name" to "On the night in question." Forty sat there and listened very carefully to the examination conducted by the defense attorney. Charisse Wilson Harding was a nurse. She lived in Texas with her husband and their four children. She had the story of life, and Sis was definitely not to be fucked with. Forty sat there, intensely staring at her. He didn't like where DeStefano was leading. "Mrs. Harding, on December 28, 1990, where were you?"
"I was in Dallas, Texas."
"Where were you, say, between the hours of 10 p.m. and 12 a.m. on the night in question?"
"Were you alone, Mrs. Harding?"
"No, I wasn't."
"Were you with your husband?"
"Objection, Your Honor. This line of questioning is irrelevant. The crime took place in Philadelphia."
"I will allow the questioning, but please get on with it," said the judge, thinking about where to have dinner.
"I'll ask you again, Mrs. Harding. Were you with your husband?"
"No, I wasn't with Charles."
"Were you alone?"
"No, I wasn't alone,"
she said, glancing at the jurors, never once looking at 40.
"Who were you with?"
"I was with Jarrell Jackson."
The room buzzed, spectators and jurors alike. The jurors were totally confused. 40 was not hearing this. He was not hearing this shit. The bitch was lying her ass off. He never seen no one look that convincing.
"She's lying! She's lying, Your Honor!"
He started screaming, wanting to run over to her and wring her lying bitch-ass neck, but he could no longer use his legs.
"She's lying! There's no way he was in Texas, Your Honor!"
"Order! Order!" said the judge as he banged his gavel.
Once quiet reigned, he told them to proceed. DeStefano continued.
"Your Honor, I would like to present into evidence receipts for tickets purchased on Mrs. Harding's credit card, showing that she, indeed, was not alone."
"Your Honor, I object. That doesn't prove anything,"
argued Parachetti. And little did he know it, but that was exactly what DeStefano wanted him to do, make a big deal over the tickets. After the battle over the tickets was settled, and DeStefano had his way, and the tickets were turned into an exhibit, he went back to his performance. He questioned Charisse Harding Wilson continually, and she made a good show of breaking down, totally distraught. She was confessing to adultery, and could lose her family, but at the same time, she just couldn't sit back and let an innocent man go to jail. 40 couldn't believe she was sitting there. That's when the tears came.
"My whole life is ruined," she said as she took the handkerchief from DeStefano's hand.
Who could deny such bullshit in the name of justice?
"Christ," thought 40.
Why is this shit happening?
He could not believe it. He was paralyzed from the waist down, and counsel for the defendant had a sobbing woman on the stand, explaining that she was married, and she didn't want to ruin her marriage or her happy life, but she couldn't let this man go to jail knowing that he didn't commit this horrible crime. The jury seemed to like the soap opera before them and sympathize with this good woman who'd got herself mixed up with that Jarrell Jackson, who didn't really look like a criminal. Meanwhile, Jarrell was sitting there, as if he was being stopped from saving the world because of this silly trial for kidnapping and attempted murder.
No more questions, Your Honor. DeStefano took his seat.
Your witness, the judge said to the prosecutor. Parrishetti knew she was lying. He went through a series of questions. The woman was a fine citizen, never had been arrested, no priors, or even a parking violation, no drug use, prescription, or otherwise. She was a registered nurse and made it perfectly clear that she was cognizant of the night in question. The drama was blinding even 40. Maybe Jarrell wasn't there, he thought and thought. No, he knew it was Jarrell. He didn't regain consciousness for 38 hours after he lost it, but when he came back, it was Jarrell, Sam, Ran, and Simone. And where was Simone? He had no idea, but he knew who did. He remembered pulling off Sam's mask. He remembered that. Then they pulled off theirs. Then Jarrell shot him. Yes, it was definitely Jarrell who was the trigger man. When Mrs. Harding was excused, defense counsel brought 40 back up on the stand, plunging into 40 with determination and consistency. However, 40 repeated his statements, never wavering, telling the jury again that they did, in fact, kidnap him, drug him, hold him for ransom, and then Jarrell Jackson shot him. By the time DeStefano was finished, the story read that Christopher Cole, a.k.a. 40, known in the street, was a drug dealer who in fact was kidnapped, was in fact shot, and yes, would be a paraplegic for the rest of his life. However, Jarrell Jackson was not guilty of these crimes.
DeStefano made his closing statements, stressing the fact that while Christopher Cole had been starved, kidnapped, and drugged with Thorazine, he probably didn't know who his captors were. He might have been hallucinating.
He doesn't know who shot him. He doesn't even know who kidnapped him, nor does he know where he collapsed. After saying he collapsed in the basement, he was, in fact, found out on the porch. This man doesn't know. And when you get up from your chairs, walk into that room and deliberate. I ask that you merely ask yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. In light of the evidence and testimony at hand, did Mr. Parrishetti prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this man did indeed commit that crime? All you need is one doubt. Because if you have any doubts at all, you will be sending an innocent man to jail.
Wiping his head, as if he had just saved the unfortunate in Bosnia, Iran, and Somalia, he told the judge, "That's all, Your Honor." 40 wanted to kill that bitch for lying. He wanted to take her long-ass legs and wrap them around her throat and just choke the bitch. He saw the way the shit was going down. Again, the system would fail. And again, the shit would fuck up what little faith a brother could have.
This is such bullshit. How could this be happening?
After closing arguments, counsel submitted their points for charge to the court, the judge deciding what statements of law would be read to the jury and what would not. The jurors then retired to the jury deliberation room to think real hard about the matter at hand. 45 minutes later, they returned. A foreman was ready to recite the verdict. Gina could not believe it. She was so close, yet so far.
Is there something else we can do?
She asked, as if all hope were lost.
Well, there's the old figure out the combination trick,
he said, pulling out a stethoscope.
What's that for?
She asked.
This is so I can hear.
Hear what?
The guy wasn't one for giving any lessons, but he tried to break it down to her the best he could.
Okay. See, near the combination is a chamber. Now, when you're turning this knob, you can actually hear. Well, it's like a pin drop.
What?
There are 7 channels set on this combination. The channels are the numbers. You don't know the numbers, so you got to listen for the numbers.
Oh, I understand. So you think you can do it?
I've done it before.
It had been an hour and a half, and he was still trying to open the safe.
Oh, my God, maybe I should try,
she said, getting frustrated.
What's in here?
Why? Why do you want to know that?
Because I can tell whatever is in here, you want it bad.
Boy, Wander, you're a real genius to figure that one out, huh?
Gina thought, looking at her Rolex. Gina could not believe it. He wasn't getting the job done. She didn't understand. She was ready to take her chances with the torch. This was not the way. Gina looked at him with such dismay and frustration that she wasn't quite sure what to say. Her main concern was whether or not she had to pay him for all the waste of time. Time was money, and wasted time was wasted money. Court was in session.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
Forty sat there. He knew the crimes charged against the defendant had been committed by the defendant. And he was guilty, and whatever punishment he received would be deemed just and fair. As the foreman rose, Forty looked at him. He glanced at Forty and made eye contact for one brief moment. Then he did the same to Jarrell, then began to read.
On the charge of kidnapping, not guilty. On the charge of attempted murder, not guilty.
Forty was stunned. On the charge of this, on the charge of that, not guilty. Jarrell was free as a bird. Jarrell hugged Billy DeStefano.
You the man, you know that, right?
Of course I am, answered DeStefano.
No gun, no witnesses, you'll always go free,
he said in a low voice.
The man was all that. $175,000 plus another $50,000. Such a small price to pay for freedom. Jarrell had been down for 6 months with no bail. He couldn't wait to get back out on the streets and start terrorizing everybody's ass again.
For reasons understood, Forty was paralyzed, blessed to be alive. He couldn't move. His mind scrambled and not guilty was ringing in his ears. Jarrell strolled up to him, making his exit from the courtroom. Bending down, he whispered in Forty's ear,
"See you in traffic, baby."
Once everything died down, including the reporters looking for a Pulitzer and the not guilty hype, Forty was left in the courtroom, sitting all alone. He might have been able to accept not being able to ever walk again in life if Jarrell had been punished. There was a lump in his throat, too big to swallow, a tear in his eye that he couldn't hold back. Just thinking about what the rest of his life would be like, as the tear rolled down his cheek. He looked up at the seal carved into the American woodwork behind the American judge's chair in the American courtroom, representing American jurisprudence.
The American eagle, he thought. The same eagle seal that's on all the money. The same money that got me here, he thought, as he looked down, holding some in his hand.
He wiped the moisture from his face and rolled out into the hallway where the officers were waiting to take him back to North Dakota. He saw the DA approaching him. He wasn't trying to hear no more shit.
"You know there will be another courtroom, and he won't be so lucky the next time. We're gonna get him. Don't worry, we're gonna get him."
40 just kept rolling. They would never get Jarrell. They would never stop the junior mafia. The boy was too large. He was untouchable.
"It's not going to open,"
said Gina, feeling all hope was lost. Then she heard the click. It was definitely a click. She heard it. And when his hand reached up and grabbed the handle on the safe door, Gina knew that all was not lost.
"Oh my God, where did all that money come from?"
His eyes were totally focused on the inside of the safe. Gina was about to faint.
"Booyah!"
kept flashing in front of her like a neon light. For one brief moment, Gina thought of this strange-looking locksmith killing her and taking her fortune. Of course, she didn't know that the locksmith was also getting paranoid, wondering if she might kill him. It was just too much money for him not to be suspicious.
"Okay, what's your name?"
"Chris," he said nervously.
"Chris, here. I think this should cover you for your troubles."
Gina reached in the safe. Taking a large stack of 50s, she handed them to him. The guy just stood there, looking like a plucked bird, unable to accept her generosity. The guy was just staring. He couldn't believe it. Gina rushed him to the door.
"Thank you for everything, Chris,"
she said, as she closed the door behind him. She went into Kwa's bedroom, and she got some pillowcases out of his closet door. She started stuffing the money in the pillowcases and sat them neatly by the door. When all the money was out of the safe, Gina had 13 pillowcases neatly lined up by the door. It was unbelievable. She couldn't think straight. She was nervous and wanted to leave. She understood how Kadir felt having this money. Shit, how could he sleep? She looked around the apartment, and she thought of Kadir. She had loved him with all her heart, had been faithful day and night, sacrificed with patience, and even though he had cheated, it didn't matter. Understanding why, as if he were right there, with her explaining everything.
"Why, I know you're here, because your money is here. Come with me. Please come with me."
Gina felt him. She felt him all around her. She knew he heard her. She knew, because there was no way anyone could rest with all that money left untouched. Oh no. Kwa was there. He was definitely in the apartment. But now, he could rest. She would be okay with that paper. He had hustled for 7 years. 7 years of hustling and grinding out there in the streets. 7 years of dodging jealous enemies. 7 years of dope fiends and pipers. 7 years of the streets. There was no one he wanted to take care of more than Gina. There was no one but Gina who was entitled to what was in that safe. And she finally found it. He had waited on her a long time. But she got it. She got it all. Gina took the poster-sized picture of them in a platinum and gold frame off the wall. She looked at it for a moment, thinking about the times they shared.
"I don't know how I've made it this long without you, baby."
She looked around for a moment as she walked to the empty safe and locked it back up. She quickly loaded the car with pillowcases, and with her pocketbook strapped around her shoulder and the last pillowcase of money in her hand, she blew a kiss into the air, hoping that in the breeze Kadir could feel her love. She turned and opened the door, but she felt something pulling at her shoulder. She turned around, but nothing was there.
"I love you, Kwa. I always did, and I always will."
Gina closed and locked the door to apartment 307. She didn't know what to do, where to go, or who to call. For the first time, Gina trusted no one. And on the strength of Kadir, she never would with his paper. Not even Rick. If Kwa didn't, why should she? She got in her baby blue Mercedes-Benz and sat there trying to collect her thoughts. She wanted to go somewhere, but where? She definitely wasn't going to the projects with 13 pillowcases filled with money.
Not,
she thought to herself. She picked up the cellular phone and called Gaget.
I'll be staying with Tracy,
she said. Okay, baby, thanks for calling me. I was starting to worry about you. You be careful, you hear me?
Yeah, tell Kalir he can sleep on the top bunk.
Knowing that fool, he'll be in the closet somewhere, or in the tub. Gina could hear Brandy crying in the background. I got to go. There goes the baby. Call me tomorrow, said Gaget.
I love you, Gaget,
she said, disconnecting the cellular line. Gina didn't want to tell Gaget about the money. Gaget didn't keep no secrets. She would be on the phone calling the Ghetto Gazette telling Gina's business.
What to do?
She asked out loud, wanting guidance. Sitting in the car, Gina thanked God for his blessings. He had truly been merciful. But a reality struck her that life was about to change. The funny thing about it was no matter how much you change, memories always stay the same. Kwa was gone, and the money couldn't take his place. It would never take his place. Nothing would ever take his place. And there would never be another love like Kadir's. When she sat back and thought about it all, his life and the time that they spent together, and how his life brought her more riches than the contents of those pillowcases, it was incomparable with the money she found in the closet. If she could give the money back in exchange for his life, in exchange to have him back, she would in a wink of an eye. Gina took the Diamond Q keychain and turned the car's ignition. She took a long look at the apartment building before pulling off toward the Ben Franklin Bridge and the New Jersey Turnpike. Her destination? Exit 16, the Lincoln Tunnel, New York City.
Just a little note. In a world where evil lurks on every street corner, and peace within oneself is a hard thing to come by, we must travel beyond mere existence and live our lives to the fullest, the best we can. Things have been so hard for a race of misused and rejected people that our African-American families today are still suffering. The streets can make you, and the streets can break you. The way you play the game is up to you. To those caught in the trap of temporary pleasures, let me tell you this. The root of all evil, which is the love of money and the next man's pain, will surely come back to haunt you. We have a choice. I believe everyone has a heart, and within our hearts is a conscience. And I know the inner peace we are lacking in ourselves can be found. I know all the burdens we carry can be lifted. I also know our perseverance and our will to survive. Love yourselves and love one another. Give yourself time to grow and open your minds to education, because it is a key to the way out. Whatever you do, make it worth something. All your consequences in life are dependent upon your behavior. If you know what the consequences are, why do you still exhibit detrimental behavior? Because you're true to the game. When I wake up to travel what is unknown, yet certain for me and for my life, throughout the day and night, I give thanks for all the many, many blessings embraced upon me. Forever protect me, forever guide me, and forever love me. You are the most merciful, the most beneficent, the most gracious. I love you.
Dear readers,
I think back to the beginning all the time, before the business of publishing became my business, before it became my life. I knew back in the early 90s that I'd have to do something to get my life together. I never dreamed it would be this. I never thought I would ever write a book, let alone sell one. I was told countless times that there was no market for a book like True to the Game. No market. Well, I guess we made that market, didn't we? People ask me all the time how I did it.
How did I sell 1 million books by myself? I always tell people I've done nothing by myself. I try all the time to explain the power of my people and how they demanded this book and how they made corporate place it on those big shelves of Barnes and Nobles and Borders. I love you so much for that, because I could never have done that by myself. I tell people how, when I started selling True to the Game in Philadelphia, it was handmade with the white cover and the gold gun on the front. People bought that book from me for $20, even though it fell apart once they opened it, because it was really handmade. To this day, they're holding that book in a plastic bag, thinking it will be worth money one day. I love you for that. I tell people how I came to New York and stood under the Mart 125, selling my book hand to hand in the freezing cold. The lady from the YMCA on 135th, who let me, a stranger, sleep on her sofa. Emil from The Rock, who let me stay at her house, wear her clothes, and drive her BMW so I could be fly and do New York. And even Lanice, aka Queen Pen, who introduced me to Brooklyn, who let me stay in her home with her children whenever I needed. I love you guys so much for that. I tried to tell people there were times when I had nowhere to go, and so I would simply sleep in my car. But you best believe, even then, I had street angels and the brothers would watch over me so nothing happened to me. I love you for that. I tried to tell people all the time I never expected others would relate to what I had written. That I had no idea my ghetto fabulous lifestyle was understood in such a way that it would transform itself into this great big business of urban fiction. I had no idea that my brothers and sisters out here would follow me and independently publish their stories and make money and have a better way of life for themselves. But you did, and I love you for that. This letter is not to say thank you, but it's to let you know that I humble myself to you, and I am so grateful. I want you to know that I will never take you for granted, and I will always love you for all that you have done for me. Truly, Terry Woods.
This concludes the reading of True to the Game by Terry Woods. Copyright 1994 by Terry Woods. This book was read by Carrie Height and Erica Peoples. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group, Incorporated, and was produced in 2019 by Blackstone Publishing and Buck 50 Productions, LLC, which hold the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.